came to a decision. He was counting on her compassion. He was counting on her compliance. Fuck that, she told herself. She stopped in front of the rock. It was a broken chunk of concrete with no business in a farm field. It had never been there before. She reached down and tried to pick it up, but it was surprisingly heavy and just rolled over on its side. Underneath, nestled in the earth, was another phone. The screen winked at her, a message appearing. Pick me up. Use the rock to smash your phone. I'll know if you don't. She stole a glance into the distance, saw nothing, then leaned down and pried the new phone out of the ground. Carefully, she pulled hers out of her pocket with two fingers. There wasn't time to talk to anyone, wasn't time to send a text. The only thing that might work was to dial the shortest possible number. As she placed the phone on the ground, when the light from the screen would be facing directly upward, her thumb made a practiced swipe, unlocking it, and then flipped open the keypad and pressed three numbers, 911. The call started to connect. She wouldn't be able to say anything, but there would be a record of it at least. Someone would know she needed help. She pretended to struggle with the rock, which didn't require much of a performance, and bought a few seconds. A tinny, almost inaudible voice issued from the phone, sounding as though it were at the end of a long tunnel. What's your emergency? Then she was out of time. No point in stalling anymore. She let the rock drop and heard the crunch of glass and plastic. The new phone chirped at her. Hide the note under the rock. Go to your car. Use the extra key in the glove box. Drive to the speedway. She pinned the newspaper cutting under the chunk of concrete. The phone chirped again. No tricks, I'll be right behind you. If he knew about the extra key, then he'd been in her car. He'd been watching her more closely than she'd previously imagined, picking apart the details of her life, waiting and planning. A knot of cold fear began to congeal in her gut. But she did have one more trick up her sleeve. And as she turned to go, in one smooth motion, the toe of her boot traced a long, thin oval in the dirt. The dart started right up. She flicked on the headlights and turned right onto the highway. Driving with one hand, she examined the phone. It looked like a cheap pay-as-you-go device, not much bigger than two post-its stuck together. The screen demanded a four-digit passcode, without which there was no way to place a call. If the phone had an emergency calling function, it had been disabled. The lock screen flashed blue. Incoming call. She didn't need the code to pick up. Lara. He stretched the vowel sounds out, taunting her. Are you excited, Lara? She pressed the phone between her shoulder and ear, focused on keeping the dart on the road. That's not the word I would use. Turn left here. She pulled the wheel to the left, checking the rearview mirror, but couldn't see anyone behind her. You're following me, she said. For a long time now. The voice replied in its childish sing-song lilt. Want to tell me your name? The voice paused. She could hear the wet sound of his breathing. Then, soon, pull into the second parking lot, the service lot. The gate will be open. Park at the back, under the trees. Walk down to the track. I'll be waiting for you, Lara. He giggled. I can't wait to meet you. Lara touched the butt of the pistol still stuck in her coat. Me too, she said. But the line was already dead. Chapter 35. Snowflakes fell like daggers through the dark, heavy with damp. They lanced straight and true out of the blackness above, torpedoing gravel as Lara pulled into the speedway parking lot. She'd been here as a girl. Even at that point, it had been closed for years, but she and her friends would traipse down the footpath to the bend in the Eno. The warm summer memory rubbed sharp against the ice forming on her windshield. The gate to the parking lot had been open, but another metal bar prevented cars from driving the last quarter mile down to the track itself. There was no choice but to walk. She wrapped a scarf around her neck and pulled a hat down onto her head. On her hands, she wore thin calfskin driving gloves, all she could find on short notice. She checked the load in the Browning, made sure it was secure in her right-hand coat pocket, and climbed out onto the thin layer of snow. The fat flakes spattered on her neck, warmed on her skin, melted, and ran down her spine. She shivered in the darkness. The racetrack hadn't had electricity in a long time, and with the cloud cover, she could barely see 3 feet in front of her face. She moved past the metal bar and started walking down the footpath. Pines surrounded it on either side, making the night seem even darker. They had a coating of snow. The whole world was covered in a layer of thick velvet, sucking up the slightest sound before it could be heard. Laura glimpsed the truth with sudden certainty. If she screamed, no one would hear it. The path was steep and unfinished, and the last 20 years of disuse hadn't improved things. Erosion had pitted the slope with holes, and more than once she slipped. At the bottom of the hill stood the remains of a ticket booth, the metal turnstile long ago pulled out for scrap. The roof of the hut had collapsed along with two of the walls. The front wall, the one with the little ticket window, still stood. Was this where Patty Finch had come on her final day in Hillsboro? Had she handed her ticket through the window? Had she touched the wooden shelf underneath? Laura ran her own gloved hand across the shelf, feeling the calfskin catch on the splinters, and the sensation shot a thrilling tingle through her hand. Or what about Hobbs? Had he touched this spot? Just as quickly, she pulled her hand back. Patty Finch. Somehow, without thinking about it, she'd gone back to calling the little boy Patty. It was how he had first entered her mind. She pictured her walking into this very place, wearing a dress and patent leather shoes, with long hair twisted into a braid, the image so lifelike that Laura couldn't shake it. She slipped and went down on one knee, the gravel and the damp biting through her jeans. The air seemed colder. It burned as she pulled it in and out of her lungs. All she could feel in her feet were 1,000 tiny needles sliding back and forth under the skin. Shivers racked her body, and she pulled the sheepskin coat close. No time for that now. She forced herself to stand, checked the Browning again, and put one foot in front of another. In 2 minutes, she emerged from the pines next to the ruins of the old stands. All the wooden parts had rotted away, but the stands themselves were large steps of poured concrete. They were undamaged after 50 years and would probably last another 150. Along the base ran a small footpath, and beyond that lay the large open swath of ground that had been the track and infield. She walked out onto the track in front of the stands, her boots crunching now in the snow. Right here, this would have been the starting line, 100 cars letting their engines rumble, and then roaring off toward the first turn. She spun in a circle, looking forward and back down the length of the track, examining the infield, gazing up into the stands, looking for any sign of life. Nothing. No light. No sounds. No footprints. She felt like the last person on Earth. And just then, the snow stopped. She looked up in time to see the dark, ragged edge of cloud move out across the horizon, leaving behind only the stars and a thick, heavy moon, huge looking near the horizon, the color of rust and flame. The shade of it shocked her. So did its brightness. The pines cast shadows on the pristine white snow. They looked like a sharp-fingered black hand creeping across the glittering ground, reaching out for her, and when it got hold. Laura whirled around, headlights slashed out toward her, shuddering and waving as the car crossed rough terrain. Every fiber of her being screamed out, "Run, hide, take cover, get away!" Anything to avoid the man coming toward her. He'd made sure at least one little girl was in the ground. Why would things be any different this time? Everything at the cabin had happened to her, even her own actions. There hadn't been time to think, only to react, and her body had taken care of that. She had made no conscious decision to run down the hill, or to go inside the door, or to walk out the back. When she thought back on it now, it was like being in a fog, and in the fog, there had been no such thing as fear or pain or doubt. This was different. Now all she had was time. The beams of light tracked toward her at a snail's pace, and the urge to flee clawed her insides like a beast. She forced herself to take deep breaths, to stand her ground. She touched the butt of the Browning like it was a talisman and willed herself to be still. As the vehicle got closer, she couldn't make out details. The headlights were too high for a car. This had to be a truck, which also explained how it could move in such rotten conditions. It had a roll bar on top and mud spatter down the sides. Rust stains pitted what had once been a dark paint color. Maybe black. "Flee," the voice said. But it was too late. The headlights finally reached her, nailing her in place. The light hit her eyes and her body tensed. Even her shivering stopped. A black truck. Mud-stained. Rusted. An inkling of recognition dawned somewhere in the back of her mind. The truck pulled up next to her, and the window rolled down, and all the fear that had been building up inside her drained out through her toes like someone had pulled the plug in a bathtub. A black, rusted truck. Jasmine Devane's truck. Jasmine leaned over toward the open passenger side window. "Need a lift?" Laura almost couldn't find her voice. "What are you doing out here?" She choked. "What the hell do you think I'm doing? You called 911. The police came and found your phone smashed out back and you gone. Not only that, you were supposed to meet Don Rogers. You didn't return his calls. No one at the Gazette had seen you. So he showed up at your house. And once he heard about the police visit from Diane, he called me." She paused. "Are you okay, Laura? Because the real question is, what are you doing out here?" "How did you know where to find me?" "I was worried you were feeling overwhelmed, that you smashed your phone out of some frustration with everything that's been going on. After our last conversation." She shrugged. "It seemed like a good guess where you might go." Laura tried to think how to explain what was happening. Words swirled in her head, but they refused to come together and make any kind of sense. "He called me," she said finally. "Who called you? Can we at least talk in the truck?" "If I leave, he'll kill Samantha Powell." Jasmine's mouth hung open, then snapped shut like a bear trap. "Get in, we'll talk. I won't drive away unless you say so." Laura stood there for a second, shivering, trying to remember what it felt like to have sensation in her feet. "You're shaking like a leaf. Just get in the damn truck," Jasmine said, then rolled up the passenger side window. Laura felt the last breath of warm air escape the inside of the cab, gave one last look around the empty track, and climbed into the cab. "I thought you'd wait out there all night." Laura didn't say anything. The vents were set to full blast, and she just held her hands up to the stream of hot air. "He called you again," Jasmine said. "It wasn't a question. Worse, he was outside my house." She gasped. "You saw him?" "Not exactly, but he saw me. He left me a note, made me destroy my phone and drive down here."
"Made you?"
"Or Samantha Powell dies, and Teresa Mitchum stays missing. He told me not to contact anyone. He's expecting me here. Alone. You need to leave." Jasmine shook her head. "Listen to yourself. Meeting him alone. For the people who care about you, that is wholly unacceptable. You must understand that." "It's my choice. You can't make me leave."
"Okay, fine. But that's a double-edged sword. I'm staying."
"You can't."
"I absolutely can. You can't make me leave either."
Laura twisted in her seat to face her. "Please. What if Teresa or Samantha is still alive? What if this is our one chance to find them?"
Jasmine shook her off. "Maybe this is just his plan to snatch you up, to make you disappear. I'm willing to take that risk, Laura said.
I'm not. Look, it's not like the place is surrounded by cops. There's not a helicopter flying through the trees. It's just you and me out here.
She bit her lip. Might still be enough to scare him off.
Perhaps. But this is as good as it's going to get. I'm not leaving.
Laura looked out the truck's back window, then turned back to Jasmine. We need to be ready when he shows up.
If he shows up.
He called me Jasmine. He's real.
And what did he sound like?
She closed her eyes and tried to remember. Soft, low, and kind of rumbly. Maybe he had a trace of an accent, but it was hard to tell. He spoke softly, but it was intense. Does that make sense?
She opened her eyes. Jasmine gazed back at her. Yes, but does it tell you anything about his identity?
Laura shook her head.
I've been over that 1,000 times in my head. He didn't say anything that could lead back to him.
Interesting.
How so?
Well, why does he take the time to contact you and to arrange a meeting if he doesn't want you to know who he is? Those two goals seem opposed. Maybe it's somebody I know. Maybe they want to surprise me.
Jasmine gave her a strange look.
Don't drag me down the rabbit hole. I didn't come here to discuss specifics with you. If he's really coming, then sitting out here is genuinely dangerous.
There's a little girl out there. She could still be alive.
Jasmine reached up and touched the cross she wore.
I pray she is.
And if your prayer comes true, we're the only ones who can help her. That alone is worth taking the chance.
Jasmine shook her head.
When will it be enough? Your perspective is warped.
When they're coerced out into the woods under a blood moon, most people find their limit.
A blood moon? Laura froze. The entire field of snow had turned into a glittering mirror, the moonlight reflecting off the ground and up through the windshield. A dark veil obscured Jasmine's face. The lower half was visible. The jaw. The lips. The teeth. The eyes were shrouded in shadow.
I shouldn't have come out here, Laura said, almost to herself.
Jasmine's jaw moved. It's nice to hear you say that out loud. It's good you can admit your mistake.
Laura rubbed her hands once more in front of the vents, then returned them casually to her lap. She willed her right hand to start moving toward her pocket. It stayed put. The disembodied jaw licked its lips.
Laura's gaze tracked downward. There, hanging just below the collarbone, was the cross. It shimmered in the moonlight, revealing every detail. The emaciated form of Jesus, the spots of tarnish, the loops of ivy winding down across its arms.
Tonight is the full moon, Laura said. Tonight is the night for sacred transformations.
Jasmine turned her head, and the crimson lunar glow splashed across her entire face.
Clenched jaw, nostrils flaring, corded tendons like rope around the neck.
The skin seemed drawn and emaciated, the face cast in bone, a skull dipped in blood. The eyes were black liquid pooled in their sockets. She blinked once, and some hidden inner working refracted through their depths. Raw, primal, somewhere between rage and ecstasy. It was the sheen of madness. Laura plunged her hand into her jacket pocket, fingers scratching, hunting for the Browning's grip. But she couldn't reach it in time. Jasmine Devane moved with inhuman speed. In a heartbeat, she was upon her.
Chapter 36. The Browning's hammer caught the pocket's edge. It snagged for only a fraction of a second. But that was enough. Laura's eyes flicked down, focused on the hunk of metal inexplicably fused to wool. She opened her mouth to yell. Jasmine launched across the truck and landed on top of her, knocking the air out of her lungs. One hand clamped down, vice-like, across her mouth before she could get a breath, and the other ripped the Browning out of her grasp and tossed it away. She could hear the air whistling in and out of her nose, the sound reminding her of prey on the plains of the Serengeti, the wildebeest or the gazelle with a lion locked on one leg, eyes pinwheeling in terror, air pistoning in and out of their nostrils. Those fights always ended the same way. And now she was such an animal. Her eyes rolled wildly in their sockets. She whipped her body back and forth, slamming her head into the passenger window. "Stop struggling," Jasmine murmured in her ear. "I've been preparing for this my whole life. Fighting back won't do any good." She tried to move, but the seat and the window and the weight of Jasmine's body pressed her into a narrowing triangle. A hoarse whisper. "You saw me at the cabin." The man in black. Oh God, oh God, oh God. Killer, child murderer. A visitor from hell sent here to drag her back with him. True panic set in, and she threw her entire body into the struggle, arching her back and screaming into the salty palm pressed into her mouth. She screamed again, and that's when the knife came out. 1 second it wasn't there, and the next it appeared like magic in Jasmine's other hand, a thin curved blade shaped like a comma, razor sharp. The tip flew toward her and stopped, resting at the nape of her neck, grazing her flesh. Then she truly understood what it felt like to be an animal, to know nothing but the need to survive. Up until that moment, her fear had been existential in nature, a fear born of speculation. She imagined all the things Jasmine would do to her, and the possibilities terrified her. Once she saw the knife, though, there was no room left in her brain for imagination. The whole world narrowed down to its wicked silver point. She thought of nothing else. She only watched it and waited. "I'll cut you if you make me." A pause filled with a heavy breath. "Don't make me." Jasmine pulled back until they were nose to nose. Lara stayed perfectly still. Jasmine moved closer, closer still, never letting the knife waver, and kissed her. A tongue, simultaneously rough and smooth, probed between her lips. "Do you like it?" Jasmine said. The knife point drilled into her throat, and the other hand slipped down the front of her body. "Do you like me?" she asked, and licked the tip of Lara's nose. Lara took a deep breath and spoke. "What should I call you? Patty Finch?" It was the wrong thing to say. The person she had known as Jasmine Devane threw back her head and shrieked with laughter. "Try again," she giggled. "Patrick Finch, then," she said, the words so quiet they almost dissolved. Something in Jasmine's face softened. "Poor Patrick. If you know about him, you must know about his mother." Lara couldn't nod, not with a razor-sharp shard of steel at her neck. She forced herself to speak. "Yes." The tip of the knife made another pinprick in her throat. "And that's how you put it together? That Patrick became Patty, became Jasmine?" "Yes." "That is so very disappointing to hear. You were supposed to be such a good little investigator." Jasmine gestured to herself. "You think this is just an act? A costume? I'm not Patrick. I never was." "You're him." Jasmine leaned back. Her hand moved in a blur and fished a small black box out of her pocket. She held it up to her face. "I'm not Patrick," she said again, and the words came out in a low, rumbly baritone. "You have to be," Lara heard herself say. "You have to be," Jasmine repeated, and Lara's words echoed back to her in the killer's voice. Jasmine shoved the box back into her pocket, then reached down and locked a vice-like grip around Lara's wrist. "I thought you knew me better than that." She tried to pull herself free, but Jasmine was stronger than she'd ever imagined. "There's still time," Jasmine said. She forced Lara's hand between her legs and pressed herself forward. The blade scraped delicately along Lara's temple. Jasmine rolled her hips and closed her legs around Lara's hand. Shaky breaths tingled in her ear. Pressure on the knife forced Lara to turn her head, and Jasmine pressed her lips to Lara's mouth.
You're a female, Laura said. Jasmine let go of her hand and smiled, and for a second, she was her old self again. Beautiful and self-aware and not at all violent. Of course, she said. Shame on you, Laura, for thinking it had to be a man. And then her face changed. The smile fell away like a discarded mask. The skin drew tight, the lips wrenched back. Her teeth were fangs in the moonlight. Laura knew this was not the time to push or to pry. This was the time for self-preservation. The survival instinct roared from the depths of her being, and no one was more surprised than she at what came out of her mouth next. Can I ask you a few questions? Jasmine paused. A reporter until the end. Is that what this is? The end? Jasmine smiled again, all sharp teeth. Laura shivered. So what's the harm in a few questions? Her therapist seemed to weigh the words. Her hand moved. Laura caught the briefest flash of light on steel before the knife vanished. Jasmine reached up, open-handed, and ran a finger through Laura's hair. Ask, she said. Laura took a deep breath. Who are you? Mildred Finch's daughter, of course. We moved here, my mother and I. It was a terrible time in my life. Horrible mothers. We have that in common. Mildred didn't have a daughter. No, she had me. She picked me out like one would a pair of shoes to match a dress. She window shopped to girls at group homes until she found the perfect accessory to complement her life, to complete her lie. And she chose me because I was so very desperate for a mommy. I've always worn my heart on my sleeve. Laura tried to ignore the sensation of Jasmine's leg snuggled up on top of hers. She adopted you. Nothing so legal. They used to line us up in the cold on Saturday mornings, like meat hanging on a butcher's hooks, and let prospective parents stare and prod at us. Sometimes another child got lucky. I never did. Then Mildred came 2 weeks in a row and spoke only to me. The third week she didn't come, and it crushed me. But I recognized her car when it pulled into the back of the lot a few days later. I recognized her face when she waved me over. She just took you? A legal adoption was never in the cards for Mildred. But she needed a daughter. She needed someone to be Patty. Patrick outlived his usefulness even before she left Virginia. He's still up there on that farm. She drank too much one time and started kicking me. She liked to hit. Only this time, she screamed something about how the old Patty was a no-good evil child, and if I didn't behave, I'd end up just as dead. Told me it was a mercy killing, and that she buried him at his favorite hiding spot, some tree near the water. Jasmine paused. That's how I found out I was a replacement. What's your name, then? Your real name? Jasmine smirked. Does it matter? Now that I'm older, I look back and see my mother with new eyes. She was weak and afraid, but she was also a genius. A genius, Laura repeated, thinking of what she knew about that torturous, deranged woman. Yes, she was right, don't you see? The human race is infected, Laura, and she taught that lesson well. Back in 1988, I hated her for it. I was an unappreciative child. So you tried to run away. 3 times, and on the third time, he found me. Hobbs. Who else? He found me and he took me. And in the process, he proved to me the truth of things. My mother was quite correct about the devils of our nature. I wasn't the last little girl he stole, but I was the first. Laura knew Patty Finch had disappeared in July, so indeed, Jasmine had not been the last of them. An image leapt into her mind. The Christmas angel, Maria Mendelssohn. It had also been a white Christmas when she was killed. The parallel of the 2 moments separated by 29 years. Snow on the ground, bitter air, the acrid taste of pennies in her mouth. Resonated so strongly that for a moment Laura felt she would vomit. The one he let live, she managed. He took us alive, you know. The first thing he made me do was strip, and then he started crying. Laura furrowed her brow. She'd poured so much time and energy into divining the mind of Eugene Hobbs. but not once had she imagined him shedding tears. I reminded him of his daughter, you see, the one that was taken from him. He chose me because I looked like her, and together we started a new family. I was ungrateful at first, but in time he came to enjoy me. He would call me his little secret, made me dress like her, made me do things. Most of all, he liked to make me watch when he worked on the others. Her voice caught in her throat. That's horrible. Yes. Now you're getting it. Just so. A horror show. But it was real, Laura. Real. Do you understand? She said nothing. Monsters exist, she whispered. But no one seems to care. You killed Olive Hansen. Jasmine slithered back across the truck's cab. The Browning appeared in her hand. Her face vanished into gloom. They cared then, didn't they? She said. Laura's jaw worked, but no words came out. Jasmine continued. With the last girl, Hobbs made me help. Something broke in me then. Something inside me I didn't know existed right up until the moment it shattered. He looked into my eyes and saw it, saw that I was broken. I was of no use anymore, so he sent me off. Just crumpled me up and threw me away. No one even bothered to look. Don Rogers did. Don't lie to me. You can't lie to me, not after so many sessions together. Not after you bared your soul. A small moan escaped between Laura's lips. It took him more than 2 decades to realize I'd been taken. No one looked for me. Someone needed to take action. So you killed a little girl, Laura said flatly. And then Frank Stewart. And then Hobbs. I dragged him into the light. The rest of them were unfortunate, undeserving. The inevitable consequence of necessity. Of your sickness. Of my plan. The morning after they found her was beautiful. I walked through the streets and watched people act out grief like wind-up dolls. Human savagery plays nightly on the news, and still they were shocked when it happened to them. The first domino had to be real. It had to be personal. A tipping point. And Teresa Mitchum? Samantha Powell? Jasmine said nothing. She secured her gloves, pulled her hat down over her hair, and reached behind her for the door latch. When the door was just cracked, she gestured with the barrel of the Browning. Get out. Jasmine, During one of our sessions, you told me no price was too great to pay for the truth. You said you'd die to know what happened to the Mitchum girl. I wonder, do you feel that way still? Please, you don't have to do this. Get out of the truck or I'll shoot you. Laura pulled the door handle and stepped down into the snow. On the other side, Jasmine mirrored her movements, climbing out at the same moment and moving backward around the truck's tailgate. For a moment, just a moment, she disappeared from view. Laura ran. She took 5 great big strides across the field, careful to lift her feet up and over the snow. She pumped her arms, willing herself to move faster. The air must have been cold moving in and out of her lungs, but she couldn't feel it. Blood sluiced through her body's pathways, wild and fierce. She wanted to live. 5 strides. She made 5 strides, and then Jasmine tackled her from behind. They slid through the snow together, Laura's face pressed down into the ground. She could feel the hidden dirt and gravel scraping across her cheek. The blood ran free down her neck. Fevered breath hissed into her ear. Jasmine flipped Laura over like she was a rag doll, then rose over her. They lay in the wide triangle thrown by the truck's headlamps. Jasmine hovered in front of the light, a dark silhouette looming over her, a shade with a gun in its hand. The gun rose until it was pointing at her, light bouncing off its polished barrel. Get up, Jasmine said. Start walking. Chapter 37. She stumbled up the diamond plate steps in the center of the stands. Behind her came a high-pitched tinny scraping and the sharp ping of metal on metal. She stole a glance backward and saw Jasmine oh so casually dragging the gun's barrel down a length of steel handrail, like a prison guard
running a baton across the cell bars. At the top, Jasmine shoved her to the left. Ahead lay one of the Speedway's only remaining structures, the old concession stand. A new tin roof had been put on sometime in the last 30 years, as though someone had wanted to use it for storage. But it still had two long rusted serving windows facing downhill toward the track, and the side door stood open. "Inside," Jasmine said. Laura froze on the doorstep. If she went inside, the chances that she would ever come back out seemed slim. The gun barrel poked painfully into her spine, but she still thought of trying to fight. If she was going to die, let it happen on her own terms. Maybe she could pretend to stumble, then spin around. If she was fast enough to avoid the first bullet, then she might have a chance. From inside the door came the in-and-out hiss of distressed and rapid breathing. "Inside," Jasmine said again. "Someone's been waiting for you." The light of the full moon had been bright, and it took her eyes a moment to adjust. She could make out several metal canisters stacked against the back wall, and next to them, the prone shape of a child. Laura ran to her, bent down and put a hand on her chest. It moved up and down. She reached up and touched the chin, then gently turned the face toward the light of the door. It was Samantha Powell. Her eyes were screwed shut like someone trying to ward off a night terror. A large bruise decorated her forehead, and one of her ears had been taped up with bandages. Her chest rose and fell, but the exhalations were far too swift for someone in a state of natural sleep. She shook her by the shoulder. "Samantha." No response. "She can't hear you," Jasmine said. "One of the benefits of my professional license is access to pharmaceuticals. Olive Hansen and Teresa Mitchum received the same treatment. If that makes you feel better." "You drugged them." There was never anything to be derived from their pain. She gestured with the gun. "Sit next to her and put out your hands." Laura did as she was told. "Now I'm going to put this gun down here." She rested it on the cracked concrete floor on the far side of the girl. "And if you try anything, we'll just see who gets to it first. Don't make me hurt her again." Laura had seen just how fast Jasmine could move. She produced a dark-colored strip of plastic and looped it around Laura's outstretched hands, mated the ends, and pulled. Laura recognized the distinctive ratcheting sound of a zip tie. Another went around her ankles, and then Jasmine stood. She pocketed the Browning, gathered up the girl, stood again, and carried her outside. Alone in the crumbling wood room, splinters scraping at her back, Laura tried to think what to do. She had tried to be understanding, but now it was time to try and rattle her cage. Jasmine came back inside and pulled the door shut behind her, then clicked a padlock onto the hasp. There was no sign of the girl. "What did you do with her?" "I wonder if her parents have finally learned to appreciate her," Jasmine said. She was almost invisible in the dark, just a blotch against the light of the door. "You're just like him, you know. He molded you until it was like looking in a mirror. He was a killer. He begat a killer. You can stop. You have a choice." The figure shook, and then a sound exploded out from behind it. Thundering, deafening, echoing off the walls. It was laughter. Jasmine was laughing. No, she was practically convulsing. Having a conniption, a bird's warble moving rapidly between deep roar and animal shriek. And as fast as it began, the laughter vanished. "Please, Laura. He killed. I kill. So we must be the same. You're such a smart woman. It's not like you to be so reductive. Take a life for pleasure and you're a beast. Take a life in self-defense and you're an honest citizen. Take a life in war, you're a hero. Intent is everything." "You don't have to do this," she said again, choking on the words. "I didn't have to do any of it, but someone had to." "For what?" Jasmine stepped into the light. "Tell me, do parents around here still let their children roam alone at night?" Laura balled her hands into fists. "Of course they don't," Jasmine Devane said. "They see the world for what it is, what it truly is.
That's my gift to them all. Perhaps someday there will be a cure for people like Hobbs. People like me. Her voice shuddered. And in the meantime, they've learned to keep their loved ones close. Some primal, fearful thing inside Laura wanted to squeeze her eyes shut, but she wouldn't let them close. She wouldn't give her that. She stared upward, defiant, and waited for whatever came next. Why else would I have drawn you to the cabin? Because the story needed to be told. It will be passed from generation to generation. A dark fable. A monster story to tell children around the fire. Why else would I have taken another girl and brought you here tonight? Because people need to know the monster still exists, lurking in the darkness, waiting. Jasmine slid down the wall next to Laura. They killed it, and it came back anyway. And us? We're just two more of his victims. Victims, Laura said. She didn't understand. Jasmine pulled out the Browning, used her sleeve to wipe all the surfaces, and tossed it into the corner. The knife got the same treatment. She produced two more zip ties. One she pulled taut around her ankles, the other she tugged onto her wrists. She caught the end between her teeth and yanked it viciously until the thin plastic edge carved into her flesh. No matter how hard they look, they'll never find the monster. I'll already be gone. Laura's head spun with the madness of it. You didn't have to tell me, she murmured. You didn't have to kill me. I didn't want to, Jasmine said, and a quaver in her voice made it sound like the truth. But you should have taken my advice and quit. Once you took those pictures from the cabin and connected them to Patty Finch, I didn't have a choice. I couldn't have you putting it all together once I'm gone. She leaned in and put her head on Laura's shoulder. But secretly, she whispered, I was pleased when you didn't listen. I'm so glad I don't have to do this part alone. She reached over, picked up one of the canisters, and popped the top off with her thumb. Almost instantly, the unmistakable odor of nail polish remover filled the room, and Laura realized it was a can of industrial acetone. Jasmine turned it over, letting the clear liquid run out onto the floor, then holding the open mouth over Laura's head. It ran down through her hair like fingers of ice, burning her eyes, dribbling down the outside of her sheepskin jacket. Already she could feel it sucking the heat off her skin as it evaporated into the room. They'll never believe it, she managed. Why not? Jasmine opened a second canister and splashed it around the room. Plenty of people know about your connection to these girls, and I was Samantha Powell's doctor. It won't take them long to find the note under the rock behind your house, and they'll find a nearly identical one on the desk in my office. We were quarry of the same predator, and we suffered the same fate. That's the story they'll put together. The smell was overpowering, nearly unbearable, but Jasmine seemed unaffected. She broke the seal on the second can and upended it over her own head, its mouth spitting clear fluid into her hair, onto her face, her coat. Even her socks were soaked. She reached into her pocket and came out with a small lighter. Laura knew from personal experience the properties of acetone. It evaporated faster than alcohol and was more flammable than gasoline. Already the room around them was brimming with its fumes. Jasmine wouldn't need to light the fire. She wouldn't need to touch the flame to anything at all. The moment flint struck steel, at the first hint of a spark, the air itself would ignite. In an instant, a fireball would consume them. But it would be over just as fast. Laura could remember watching videos of people dipping their hands in acetone, lighting them on fire, and then snuffing them out. The liquid evaporated so quickly that it had a tendency to form a cool barrier near surfaces, above which the vapors burned. That was it, then. Her only chance. Jasmine held the lighter out in front of her. Her eyes glistened, and she opened her mouth, probably to say some final words. Laura would never know for sure. She lashed out with all her strength, whipping both legs upward into the bottom of Jasmine's wrist. She didn't let go of the lighter, but the tie around Laura's ankles snapped in half. She rolled once, twice, three times across the concrete floor, then pulled her knees into her chest.
She reached over her shoulder, got a grip on her coat's collar, and yanked it up over her head before balling herself up, making herself as small as possible inside the thick sheepskin lining. The lighter clicked. An intense bloom of heat washed over her, accompanied by a deep percussive report. All the air in the room suddenly went missing, and she gasped and opened her eyes. The ends of her hair were on fire. The coat was in flames. There was no way to remove it, not with her hands tied together. A glint in the corner caught her eye, and she recognized the knife only a few feet away. Pinning it between the toes of her boots, she bent forward and sawed her wrists back and forth across the blade, begging the plastic to give. Her left shoulder and the center of her back started to sear, but she ignored it, kept moving, kept cutting. With a crack, the plastic parted. She slipped out of the jacket and kicked it away. The walls were burning, and she could hear the tin roof starting to pop as it reshaped itself in the heat. She turned, and for a second she froze. Jasmine was in the corner of the room, on her knees, her face invisible, a sheet of dripping flame where it used to be. But she was alive. She reached her bound hands out toward Laura, as though begging her to stay. Then came a sound like crumpling paper as the fire ate through the last can of acetone. The entire back wall erupted in a furious blaze. Laura threw herself against the door, but it didn't move. She shoved her fingers under the articulated metal door, closing off one of the serving windows, and pulled, screaming. It screeched upward, the wheels turning ponderously in their rusted tracks. It came up 10 inches and stopped. She jerked savagely at it, the metal cutting her palms, the heat growing at her back, but it wouldn't move again. She turned her head and forced it out through the opening, then expelled all the air out of her lungs and pushed, but couldn't get herself through the gap. The pain in her feet was unbearable. Suddenly Cooper, Roger's bloodhound, burst from the tree line, came to heel in front of her, threw back his head, and bayed. Don Rogers struggled out of the trees and skidded to a stop behind the dog, thick blankets of mist pouring out of his mouth. "Gotta lift it," she managed to say, and he understood. He braced himself against the outer wall and got his palms up under the door. "Ready?" he said. "Together. 1, 2, 3. The door groaned once, then shot up another 2 inches before wedging in place again. He grabbed her by the elbows and squeezed her out under the door. She hit the ground roughly, but he kept dragging her backward. Glancing down, she noticed her pant legs were burning. Somehow the pain didn't seem to register in the moment. "My legs are on fire," she said. "Shit." He rolled her back and forth through the snow, then pulled off his jacket and beat out the final flames before collapsing in a heap next to her. Laura forced herself to speak. "Samantha?" He jerked a thumb over his shoulder. "She's back there, wrapped in a blanket. Couldn't wake her up, but she's alive." Laura nodded and closed her eyes. She thought she had never been so tired in all her life. Cooper bounded up and licked her hand. Rogers tousled his ears.
"He found you. Followed your scent right up the slope. The police showed up to investigate that call your mother told me, although it wasn't easy getting it out of her. Cooper led me right to the spot you'd been standing, and I saw your message scratched in the dirt."
"Good boy," she said. Rogers looked at the shed, now totally engulfed in flame.
"Anyone else in there?"
"No one who could be saved," she said, and let her head fall back against the ground. The last thing she saw before slipping into unconsciousness was the orange and red spark shooting upward between the pines. Chapter 38. Her call was picked up on the third ring.
"Finch residence. Francine speaking."
"Francine, is your mom there?" She could hear a muffled shout for her mother, and then,
"May I ask who's calling, please?"
"It's Laura Chambers, the reporter. I came out there and visited you."
"Yes, I remember. Did you find what you were looking for?"
Laura didn't know how to answer that.
"Hello?
Do you have a second to talk? Maybe away from Francine." Another muffled conversation, then the swing and squeak of a screen door. Laura could picture her on the sunny front porch.
"I'm here. Is it about my cousin?"
"I wanted to ask you.
Did Patrick have a favorite spot to hide? Maybe near a tree, one by the pond? A pause.
There's only one way you could know that.
You found him. Where is he?
Lara tried to keep the falter out of her voice.
He never left, she said.
It was Christmas morning, and the icicles hung in the trees like God's ornaments. Shacks speckled the ridges and ravines, low-slung homemade constructions with walls of exposed gypsum board and used pallets. The Dart's engine struggled on the upslopes. This part of the Blue Ridge Mountains ran steeper than Lara had expected. Working the manual transmission was a bitch. She wore a heavy parka, a leftover from Boston, on her upper body, but just a loose-fitting skirt on her legs. Thick white gauze wrapped them from the ankles to just above her knees, where her injuries from the fire had crescendoed. Her feet and back had been burned as well, but heavy boots and a thick sheepskin coat had protected her to some degree. Those places on her body would mend completely, the doctor said, but the scars on her legs would never heal. She would carry them for the rest of her life. The building, when it came into view, stood in shocking contrast to the others in these mountains. Tall ramparts of gray stone, a Tudor-style roof shingled in slate. The gravel drive ended in front of a set of thick wooden doors. Above them, etched into the stone, the words St. Jude School. She had never seen a place quite like it. Lara took a deep breath, then knocked. The left-hand door opened almost immediately. She'd called ahead. They were expecting her. Miss Chambers? A thin, beak-nosed woman peered out at her. She wore a dress of gray flannel, black stockings, and simple penny loafers. Sister James?
Yes, we spoke on the phone. Please come in.
The sister stood aside, and Lara moved past her into a large stone-walled foyer. It smelled of incense, and the only light came from a pair of high casement windows facing south. The door creaked shut behind her. The room darkened.
Your phone call was very vague, Sister James said. We endeavor to help wherever we can, but more information may be required.
The sister spoke with a relearned elocution. She had clearly worked hard to transform herself, but every third syllable betrayed a local heritage. She was born and bred in Western North Carolina.
On the phone, Lara said, you mentioned Sister Coleman, yes.
She cut her off casually, like a teacher overruling a student. Lara supposed she was a teacher. They all were here.
Can I speak to her?
Of course, of course. They moved through another door and up a set of winding stairs, down a hall and into a library or a sitting room. It too had casement-style windows and walls covered with books. A row of chairs ran down the middle. In the last chair sat an old woman wearing a nun's habit. Sister James indicated toward the end of the room, and Lara went and sat in the opposite chair.
Sister Coleman?
The old woman, who Lara had thought asleep, opened one eye and peered out from under a thick eyelid.
The one and only.
Lara smiled. Where Sister James was trying to mimic something like received pronunciation, like an actress playing a nun in a movie, Sister Coleman seemed to have discarded such theater long ago. Her voice was pure Brooklyn.
Well, what do you want?
Sister Coleman, I'm Lara Chambers.
Sister Coleman made the sign of the cross.
Glory be, the one who fought that devil.
Yes, ma'am.
The one who called.
Yes.
The one who sent us that picture.
From over her shoulder, Sister James said, we have a computer in the office. It doesn't get much use, and I'm afraid it didn't see your email until a day or two after it came in. But I passed it around after that. Sister Coleman recognized it right away.
Still have my eyes, you know,
Sister Coleman said.
Thank God for that, Lara said.
What?
She rapped her cane twice on the polished wood floor.
You'll have to speak up. My ears are a different story.
You recognized the picture,
Lara said, spacing the words out.
Of course I did. This place is beautiful, isn't it?
Lara just nodded.
Was a convent back before we started taking in children. Back when people actually became nuns. Even today, this property, this building, is just about all of our net worth.
Lara looked at Sister James. Sister Coleman reached out with the tip of her cane and poked Lara in the shin.
Don't do that. Don't give her that look like, is the old woman senile? I'm not. This, she tapped her temple, is like a steel trap. I've got a point, you know. My point is, we never had much. Not much money in raising unwanted children, if you can believe it. So when a company had a misprint and asked us if we wanted that load of coloring books, we said, send over the lot. She grinned, half of her teeth missing. Turned out to be a truck's worth. We used those things for years and years. I may be 91 years old, but how could I forget?
Laura studied her for a second, then asked, and the name?
Yes, yes, I recognized that too. Strange case, that girl. She disappeared. We figured her for a runaway. We get plenty of those up here. But almost 2 years later, a man with a pockmarked face drops her back off, along with a very healthy donation. We never saw him again. We recognized the girl, but she'd changed her name. Insisted we call her Patty. She paused. It didn't go well for her here.
What happened?
Well, she was here for another 3, perhaps 4 years. By that time, she was a young woman. And one day, she just vanished.
Ran away again?
So we guessed.
Ever see her after that? The old woman closed her eyes, swayed side to side.
Maybe,
she muttered.
Maybe.
Sister Coleman?
Her eyes snapped open again. Said I never forget, and that's the truth. But the mind needs more breaks these days. Sometimes I drift off.
You saw her again?
6 months ago. A woman showed up here calling herself Jasmine. If it was the same person, probably she didn't think there'd be anyone left to remember. I didn't recognize her at the time. Just saw the look in her eyes.
The look?
Young thing like you would hardly understand. When you get old, all your life's behind you. All that's left is memories. Spend enough time with memories, good and bad. And it gets so you know the look of someone reliving theirs. That woman from 6 months ago, she took one look at these old stone walls and got a shimmer in the eyes, like she'd seen a ghost. You might not understand this, but when it comes to memories, some places are more haunted than others.
I do understand, Laura said. The old woman studied her face.
I think you do indeed. Anyway, I saw the newspaper article yesterday, you and that business at the racetrack, and they ran the story again this morning. They printed the picture in full color.
And it's the same person?
Sister Coleman squinted. I'd be lying if I said I was 100% sure, but that's where I'd place my bet.
Why did she come? To relive the past? The old nun snorted.
Don't think so.
Then why? Sister Coleman shrugged, as though it were obvious.
To bring us the girl.
By the time Laura's heart had finished fluttering, and her hands had stopped shaking, they were down the hall standing in front of another ancient wooden door.
She's in here, Sister Coleman said. Physically, she's in good health.
Laura's mouth was parched. Her tongue felt like an overstuffed pillow. Other than physically? Sister Coleman leaned against the wall.
Well, there's no shrinks up here. The nearest regular doctor is almost 2 hours away. I'm a nurse myself.
But
she doesn't look at you, doesn't interact with the others, doesn't shed a tear. That's unusual for a new girl, even stranger. I've been with her 6 months, and she hasn't spoken a word. There's nothing wrong with her tongue or vocal cords, I checked. We called the police, but we get so many strays up here, they don't always pay attention.
Laura nodded. Her hands still trembled, but she pushed the door open anyway. The room was organized as a dormitory, long and narrow, with windows on one side and 2 rows of single beds. At the end, on the second to last bed, a girl sat facing away from the door. Laura hobbled down the aisle,
the foam bottoms of her hospital flip-flops chafing on the stone floor, lowered herself onto the last bed, and looked at the girl. The girl wouldn't meet her gaze. Her head stayed bent in a permanent bow, and a sheet of tangled black hair hid her face. The girl's body was too small. Her knees were knobby. The wrist bones threatened to poke through the flesh of her arm. Laura reached out to touch one. The girl gave a start, pulled back. "Mildred doesn't eat much," Sister James said. Laura raised her eyebrows. "Mildred? That's the name we were given." "Do you think Mildred and I could have a second alone?" Sister James tapped her foot for a second, the sound echoing sharply in the empty dormitory, then retreated. Laura waited for her to get to the other side of the room, then said, "Mildred, is that your name?" The girl didn't move. She could have been a statue. "I didn't think so." The girl said nothing. "What about Teresa?" That got her attention. She sat up so fast it looked like her head was about to pop off. The long black hair flicked off her face, and she stared back at Laura with huge brown eyes. One ear was missing, a mass of scar tissue in its place. Her mouth opened, then closed again. She pointed to herself. Laura nodded. "Teresa Mitchum," she said. And the girl began to cry. An explanation to the Holy Mother, followed by an emotional phone call to Angie Mitchum, was enough for the St. Jude School to sign Teresa Mitchum into Laura's care. When the school's headmistress had finished, Sister James took the receiver and passed it along. Silence. Then, as if from a million miles away, "Is it really her?" "It's her."
"She's alive?"
Angie asked.
"Yes." "She's alive and well?"
Laura didn't reply. Angie Mitchum began to whimper. The cries burrowed into her ear. She would never get them out.
"Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Jesus.
I'm bringing her home." Angie blew her nose.
"Are you going to write the story? Somebody's going to write it. I'd like if it was you."
"I'm going now, Angie. We'll leave straight away." She placed the receiver in its cradle. It would be a hell of a story. The book advance alone would catapult her wherever she wanted to go. But her dreams, coiled spring-like for so long inside her, seemed to have lost their tension. Her hometown was just another brown spot under the same scrubbed blue sky. Was there a place so beautiful it could make her forget? She doubted it. Some parts of this story weren't for telling. They were just for her. They would die with her. They packed what things she had, stopped by the second floor library to see Sister Coleman, who kissed the girl once on the forehead but uttered not a word. And then they were off, bouncing over the rutted trail out of the mountains, racing down the freeway, heading east, and still the girl said nothing. After a while, Laura flipped on the radio. Teresa turned the dial back and forth. Sometimes she would land on a radio station and stay for a while, listening. Sometimes she would land on static and listen just the same. They drove with white noise playing for a spell. As the next town approached, silent night faded in through the hiss. The girl with one ear leaned forward, transfixed, and closed her eyes. Laura tried not to stare. Frozen, once again a statue, she was a living memorial to all that had happened, a monument both to life's misery and to its hidden corners still replete with hope. She was lightning in a bottle. Laura watched the girl out of the corner of her eye and waited for her to move. "It's Christmas, you know," she said. And the girl nodded. This concludes the reading of Last Girl Gone, a Laura Chambers mystery by J.G. Heatherton. Copyright 2018 by Grant Heatherton. This book was read by Laura Jennings. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Crooked Lane Books and was produced in 2018 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update
telling you about new releases. Call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.